And I was busy still buying birthday presents for my daughter, who turns 27 on Monday. I love the expedited shipping that you can get these days to make sure that you look like a good parent. You are in the Senate Education and General Government Committee. I'll give you my same rule. I give every day my same admonition. If you have a cell phone, PDA, or computer, make sure I don't hear it. That means turning it off. Otherwise, we ask that you make a contribution to the Common School Fund, your favorite charity while you're in my committee. We are going to hear Senate Bill 417 first, and that's scheduled for an hour. So if you're here for Senate Bill 46, you can hang out or come back. And with that, I am going, and if you would like to sign up to testify, you can do that over there on the side table. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 417. Ms. Richardson will explain the bill, and then we'll call up people who wish to testify.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 417 abolishes the Lane County Boundary Commission. It transfers funds, rights, and obligations of the Lane County Boundary Commission to Lane County. It would abolish the Lane County Local Government Boundary Commission Fund. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. And I have two esteemed colleagues here who are from my neck of the woods who would like to testify, Representative Chris Edwards and Representative Phil Barnhart. I don't know
who's... Let you get in there first.
You can just state your name and location of representation for the record and then begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Chris Edwards, State Representative from House District 14, representing West Eugene, Santa Clara, and Junction City.
And I'm Phil Barnhart, State Representative, House District 11.
Great.
The copies of my testimony are being passed out right now, and I can get a little excited when talking about this topic, so please feel free if I start to stray, Madam Chair, to rein me in at any time. I'm here to support Senate Bill 417, which would essentially abolish the Lane County Boundary Commission. And I'd like to give you a little bit of background and about the commission before getting into the meat of it. The Boundary Commission is defined in Oregon statute. It is a commission of 7 members appointed to 4-year terms, and they're appointed by the governor. And I wanted to make sure that we're clear on that so that we understand that this is the purview of the legislature to be talking about this topic, and so that there's no confusion about whether or not it's a local versus a state entity. It is appointed at the state level. Essentially, what's really brought this issue to the forefront has been the Boundary Commission's role in Lane County in making annexation decisions. My district encompasses a large area of, well, Santa Clara is outside of the, big portions of it are outside of the city of Eugene, but are inside the urban growth boundary. And so just a little bit of background about Santa Clara's annexation situation. I know many of you are probably familiar with the annexation topic, especially with Senate Bill 887 moving through the building this last session. Santa Clara, unfortunately, has probably become the poster child for how annexations should not be handled, and it really is... Well, frankly, it's egregious. In 1982, the Metro Plan laid out that within the urban growth boundary, Eugene would be the eventual provider of services, the city. And then through a series of subsequent intergovernmental agreements, the county began the process of handing services over to the city. Now, where this becomes problematic is that, let's say, a homeowner wants, in their efforts to get full enjoyment and use of their property, say they want to build a greenhouse in their backyard, or they want to do a big addition onto their house, and they, let's say, are in an unincorporated area of the county, but they're within the urban growth boundary, then these intergovernmental agreements stipulate that they must request annexation by, they must request that the city annex them. Those requests go to this boundary commission. The boundary commission then rules on them, and more often than not rules in favor of the party requesting annexation. Now, often the city will also come to those same boundary commission meetings and request that a length of street or road or public right-of-way also be attached to the annexation request. And so what we have is a situation where we have big areas of unincorporated property which are being surrounded by nothing more than city streets. Well, they're not city streets. They would like them to become city streets, but surrounded nonetheless by no more than public right-of-ways. Once an island is created, then by Oregon statute, that those lands can be annexed forcibly by the city. Now, it's a stretch to say that an individual property owner coming to the boundary commission and requesting annexation because they have to, perhaps it's a stretch to say that that's a forced annexation, but I would contend that it's at least a coerced annexation. And the entire process has been, frankly, undemocratic, because you have folks who, by definition, do not have representation on the city council because they're unincorporated. They have representation by one county commissioner of five, and that county commissioner represents all the way from Santa Clara all the way to the coast. And this is all being carried out, but none of these current elected officials actually have to deal with the annexation issue because this template was laid out in the Metro Plan, and then it's carried out on an ongoing basis by the Boundary Commission, which again is a state a governor appointed board. And so during the entire process, there is no accountability to a local electorate. And it's a really destroyed trust among Santa Clarans in the city and in the county. And I think it's going to behoove everybody in the long run if we start rebuilding that trust. And so I'm strongly in favor of Senate Bill 417, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Edwards, and I appreciate that you didn't read your testimony, but you summarized it, which is really, for a freshman, I'm surprised that you learned that right away. I very much appreciate it.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Can I just say that you never did that as a freshman?
Actually, I think I might have. But what I appreciate about it is that it gave us an opportunity to really listen to what you were saying, and your testimony provides more detail, your written testimony. But let me ask you this. Your district is part of my district, correct?
That's correct.
And this is an issue that we heard over and over again in the last couple of years, at least. Would that
over
be correct?
And over and over.
Okay. And then when Representative Barnhart testifies, I'm going to have him touch on the fact that this bill came before the legislature last session and what happened to it and why we're back. So any other questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, might I point out also that we did include a map.
I see that.
And the map, the pink line represents the urban growth boundary. The dark black line is the city of Eugene, the city boundary, and then all those checkerboard squares and boxes represent city property outside the city limits, but inside the urban growth boundary. And so that's what That's what we're dealing with in Santa Clara. And I myself live in Santa Clara. I live in the city. And if I look this way across the street, I've got county property. And if I look this way across the street, I've got city property. So it's a real checkerboard, and that's because of this process that's really been, it's not working. So thank you.
Great, thank you. And one more question for you, and then we'll turn it over to Representative Barnhart. There were originally three boundary commissions that were created in Oregon, correct?
I don't know. I will take your word for that. I don't know how many boundary commissions.
Yeah, the special districts are going to testify, and they'll talk about that. And this is really the only remaining boundary commission.
Yes, that's correct. Lane County is the one of 36 counties that has a boundary commission.
Great, thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before the committee and talk a little bit about Senate Bill 417. The issues in my district are slightly different than the issues in District 14, but they have the same basic cause, and that is this governor-appointed boundary commission as an extra layer of government in the county that requires an extra layer of activity. This issue came to my attention 2 years ago around the concerns of the small cities in my district, primarily Coburg and Creswell. And I think you're going to hear this morning, well, you will hear this morning from Mayor Petitti of Creswell and also Mayor Williams of Cottage Grove, not in my district but just south of my district, about some of their concerns about the Boundary Commission and the way in which it interacts with city government. I also understand that there is a concern about a drafting piece of the way this bill is drafted, and it may be needed. There may be an amendment needed in order to fix it. There is someone from the League of Oregon Cities here who will speak on that issue. What we would like, I think, is that the cities in Lane County have the same kind of authority as the cities in other places, and then that the issues that Representative Edwards is raising be dealt with in the other bills that are being considered here. But, of course, he raises an important issue just the same. Part of what we're dealing with is the understanding of the people about the way government works. And to have this extra agency established by the governor, appointed by the governor, established by the legislature, in the middle of the local planning process continues to be a problem as far as we're concerned. I think the only local government agency that actually likes it, or has liked it in the past at least, is the City of Eugene. Mayor Lykin could not be here this morning from Springfield, but I believe his position will be very similar to the position of Mayor Petitti and Mayor Williams on this issue. So the issue came up last time. I think the local delegation from Lane County was convinced after significant lobbying that it was premature to bring it up last time, and so the bill was not carried forward. But we're convinced now, after further study, that the bill that it's timely and it ought to be passed. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Yes, there was a lot of arm-twisting last session, and we were all convinced this was bad and evil to do this, and we've since seen the light.
We've repented our ways. Yes,
I appreciate that comment. Any questions from the committee?
Question, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Westland.
Thank you. Representative Edwards, Representative Barnhart, I am assuming, I'm under the assumption there is no overlap or interference with our COGS, their function, Council of State Governors. This is a totally separate function from service delivery of coordination of services provided by certain governmental entities, as opposed to these council type functions.
Right.
Just apples and oranges.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Westland. Yes, that's right. I was actually a member of the Lane Council of Governments for a while as the school board representative from the Eugene School District before I came to the legislature. Those functions are completely separate They provide many very important services,
exactly,
as you know, but they're not related to this issue.
I'm a big fan of COGS.
And I am too, Senator. Thank you.
Senator Cruz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. I just wanted to say hi to my good friend, Representative Barnhart. Due to our schedules, we haven't even had a chance to have a conversation this session.
And
we need to remedy that.
Thank you.
Okay. Gentlemen, I do want to ask you to make one thing very clear in the bill. On page 2, colleagues, lines 1 through 3, it says the equitable distribution to local governments as defined in ORS 174116 within Lane County for the purpose of paying the costs of those local governments that are associated with future boundary changes. So what they're going to do is take the money that is currently in the Boundary Commission's account and move that to the different jurisdictions that this encompasses, which would be the various cities within the county. Is that correct?
That, Madam Chair, that is my understanding as to the way this bill is drafted. Essentially under Section 3, and there are several subsections of that, to make an equitable distribution. I don't believe there's any controversy about that particular section.
No, there was some question about an unfunded mandate, but as I look through the materials from last session's bill, which was House Bill 3265, there is a statement in there from Legislative Fiscal that there was no unfunded mandate because the money was going to go out to the cities and the and that are making up that jurisdiction.
If I may, Madam Chair, in fact, this may very well lead to a reduction in costs because we reduced the whole layer of government.
Right.
In the process of repealing the Boundary Commission.
Right. All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you. I know you have committee. I appreciate that you came by today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, we appreciate Chris coming by.
Let's see. I think I'd like to hear from Amanda Rich next from the Special Districts. Just give us a little bit more detailed background, and then I'd like to hear from some guests in our room. Not that Amanda's not a guest, but...
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members of the committee, good morning. My name is Amanda Rich, and I'm here today representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. And you have heard reference to House Bill 3265 that was brought last session that would have, as I believe, is an almost exact copy of this bill, real close. And we actually, that bill was brought at our request, and the Special Districts Association brought that bill forward because of concerns that had been brought to us by citizens in Lane County trying to form special districts and difficulties that they had encountered in essentially trying to self-govern and create service districts for provision of services to their communities, and had run into trouble with the Boundary Commission, and in particular with some very direct, very pointed policies that the commission carries out. And you've heard about troubles with annexation in the Santa Clara area. I'd like to point out to you a couple of policies that the commission has that are directly related to formation of special districts. But before I do that, we've asked for a little bit of background on the formation of these commissions, you know, how they came about and what their purpose was at the time. In 1969, the legislature actually established three boundary commissions. Now, you have to remember, this is pre-land use planning in Oregon. This is the wild, wild west, and folks were dealing with rapid growth and looking for ways to provide services, and it was kind of pell-mell, and there were units of government being created without a whole lot of organization. And so the legislature in order to remedy this problem, created three boundary commissions, one in the Metro Portland area, one in Salem, and one in Eugene. The Lane County Boundary Commission is the last of those commissions. The other two have been abolished. First, I believe, was the City of the Salem Boundary Commission, and then followed by the Portland Boundary Commission in 1999. And frankly, the reason that they went away is not because we didn't need land use planning anymore. It's because of the inception of LCDC and the processes that you're all very well aware of. And it became a duplicative process to have a boundary commission because that function was being served in other areas by the counties and by the cities. And so essentially, you'll see in my testimony that I believe that the Boundary Commission has essentially become an anachronism in today's in today's era of land use planning. But beyond that, beyond just the fact that it is maybe an extra layer of government and it's it has served its purpose and its time is maybe gone, there are active policies that are of concern. You've heard one expressed by Representative Edwards about policies regarding annexation. I'd like to point out to you in the OARs that I printed off just this morning. They're fresh off the web. You'll find that it's about the fourth page down in my testimony, OAR 191-030-0000, sub 1. And it's about the second or third sentence in there. It says, the commission shall favor general purpose governments over single service governments and special districts. And then further on in the policies, you will find a policy that says annexation to cities shall be the method preferred and encouraged by the commission for delivering urban services to urbanizable land. And we get really concerned when we see this kind of language because we believe that citizens should have a fair shake when they go before governing bodies in attempting a formation of a special district. And the deck shouldn't really be stacked against them. Going into a process with the Lane County Boundary Commission, it's a foregone conclusion that they are going to be weighted heavily against the formation of a special district, and we just don't believe that in this era of tightening budgets, of disappearing ONC funds, that we need to be preordaining what the best provision of government services is. I think every area and every community should have kind of a fair shake at deciding how they believe their services should be delivered. And we're talking about folks who are saying, we want to tax ourselves. We want library service. Or we want a park district to provide us with park services, and we are willing to tax ourselves in order to do that. And they're going through all of the processes that they need to bring this formation forward, and they're kind of getting hit with this brick wall. And we see it time and time again with folks that have come to the special districts and said, can you help us out with this? So you know, I'm not going to you've heard some excellent testimony from other folks, and I won't burden you with any further testimony unless you have specific questions about this. I will mention a couple more things. You heard the story about last session, and we actually were encouraged at the end of last session that the issue had been raised and that there was going to be a work group and folks were going to get together and talk about these policies. And to my knowledge, that never happened. And so I think that there was an opportunity for the Boundary Commission and its supporters to address the issue, and I think that opportunity has passed. And then I would just I guess that's all I would like to add. Just that if there's concern that this that there hasn't been a chance to address this, I think that there has been, and it's time to go forward with this legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Rich. Can I ask you to just illustrate a point? Take a special district. I think a library district. Has there been an effort to form a library district in community within the Boundary Commission?
There has been. The Lane Library League has been attempting for years to form a special district that would serve the areas that are within the urban growth boundary but are outside of the city of Eugene. And they're kind of in this no man's land of service, where there's this overarching policy that you heard Representative Edwards refer to that states that the city shall be the sole provider of urban services, and libraries in the Metro Plan are defined as urban services, and that's actually unique, I believe, to Lane County. And so these folks are stuck in a rough position where they're not annexed into the city, and so they're not really eligible for direct service, library service from the city. They're within the UGB, and they are within the purview of the Boundary Commission, but they can't form a special district to provide services or to get their library service, because urban services, library services are supposed to be provided by the city, and the Boundary Commission carries forth that policy against special districts providing that sort of urban service. And so it has just been a quagmire to try to kind of wade through the different layers of policy that have put these folks in this position. But the bottom line is these are folks that need library service and can't get it. The current government structure is preventing them from being able to self-govern, tax themselves, and create the services that they need.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. I appreciate that explanation.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to call up Mr. Seabury. Who came with you to testify? You want to come up? Just state your name for the record. Tell us where you're from.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Senators. I'm David Van Sickle, President of the River Road Santa Clara Properties Owners Association in Eugene.
And Mr. Seabury?
My name is Jim Seabury, and I am the founder and a past president of the River Road Santa Clara Property Owners Association, and I had to give that office to a very competent person to my right, because I moved into the city out of desperation.
And you're now, you're still in my Senate district, however. You're just on the other half of the House side. Well,
and
great.
It's a pleasure, Senator Walker, to testify before your esteemed committee. And
thank you. Would you like to go first, because you sort of handed the reins off to Mr. Van Sickle, where he learned all of that he needed to know from you, right?
I'd be happy to do that.
All right.
First, I must apologize, and if you'd rather that if this can't be done, then let me know. All right. The testimony that I've submitted is under the name of Jerry Finnegan, who is the chair of the Santa Clara Community Organization, which was formed by Lane County, but is now recognized by the city of Eugene, and their logo seems to appear on it, and they get some funding from that. And his signature appears at the bottom of the written testimony, and to the right appears mine. And he gave me permission to read it. But I'm going, you know what? I'm going to deviate. Believe me when I say it's a marvelous testimony. But I don't believe that it's going to draw questions from you, and I think that you're entitled to ask questions. And I hope to gosh that I have enough history in this matter to respond to them. Please, I'm now 78 years old, and the old memory sometimes slips, but let's get to the subject.
Okay.
The Boundary Commission. I'm sure that the Boundary Commission, when it was formed with very good intentions, and the governor had good intentions, and it had a valid purpose. However, today, I don't know why that we go to public hearings, because there is no justice in that Hall of Justice. That's a quasi-judicial body. We've challenged in writing with petitions in remonstrance of decisions on their final orders. They've been addressed to the Boundary Commission. I've asked members of the Boundary Commission if they received it. And if you want names, I'll name names, but I'll try to avoid that. One of the commissioners said, when we asked after the meeting, did you see this? She said, I've never seen that. So we have commissioners that don't receive communication. That's not of their fault. We have a situation where during an annexation of a voluntary annexation, and we have at the beginning of that staff input on the situation. That's fine. And then we have those speaking against, we have those speaking for, and then we terminate the public input, and I sit where a commissioner asks a question of staff, and the staff person criticizes my testimony, and I can't refute it. This is after closing the input of the public is cut off. And I would venture to say that includes city staff. They're public at that point of the game. You want to talk to the person who's submitting the documents for the annexation of his property so he can develop it. That's a different story. Now, the other things that happen. I actually met with a gentleman who had an application. He's with St. Vincent de Paul to develop his piece of property involved in a street annexation. And that would have encircled some 93 properties and made them eligible for annexation under the cherry stemming or the island type of annexation. We call it superfluous street annexations. That's our terminology. In speaking with this gentleman, he said that when he first went to planning to get his start his application process, that they wanted to piggyback the streets on his application. And he says, I really don't want enemies here. That's not what St. Vincent de Paul is about. And they said, well, this is one of the chief persons in this annexation situation. He goes over and testifies all the time before the Boundary Commission. He says, that could hurt your expedited process of your property. Okay. When I gave testimony before the Boundary Commission, that gentleman was there. And I knew I was out of order when I did it, but I turned and I pointed backwards to him and I said, didn't I speak with you on this matter? That you had been coerced into this? To have roads added to that? And they said, you're out of order, Mr. Seabury. I said, yes, but one of the nice ladies on the Boundary Commission, very seldom, if ever, votes with us, but she said to city staff, that is bad. Okay, and they did not approve the street because of that either.
So, Mr. Seabury, if I could summarize, because we have other people who want to testify this morning.
Sure.
Your feeling is that the Boundary Commission just has not been responsive to the citizens
not at
who
all.
Come before.
Absolutely not.
And
absolutely not.
And you think that elimination of the Boundary Commission and making these issues go before the various cities and county commissions would be more helpful and responsive?
Absolutely. The laws are already in place.
Okay.
222.750 doesn't go away. It's there. It's the principal act. And when you, by the way, when you couple that with that streets, all of a sudden you have a different set of descriptions for street annexations in the law from what you have for the Boundary Commission. And when you put the two together, all of a sudden you don't have a law.
Okay,
because they're in conflict with each other.
All right. I appreciate that testimony, and we'll also read this one, and maybe I'll let Mr. Van Sickle speak for a few minutes, and then we need to have some other folks come up and tell us their views. Mr. Van Sickle?
Okay. The Boundary Commission was organized to help the local Metropan and the unincorporated neighborhood of River Road to stop them from incorporating. They accomplished that deed several years ago. Now they're underneath a layer of government that's functioning as a rubber stamp for the city of Eugene. Lane County and Eugene need to function under the current state statutes that does not, as does the rest of the state jurisdictions. The rest of the state has not been having any problem. People mention services. What is Eugene going to offer as a service to that area? They don't own E-Web. That's an elected board. That's power and water. They have a sewage district. They don't run that. The fire departments, below the Beltline, River Water District, gets fire department, purchases it from the city. North of the Beltline, Santa Clara Fire Department. Basically, the only thing the city of Eugene can offer is a library card. That's the only leverage they got. Streets? Yeah, I pay gas taxes. State gas taxes go to road repair. City gas taxes go to road repair. However, there are some outstanding side effects of your bill. The key words are contiguous and forced annexation. At present, an IGA between the city of Eugene and the city dispenses all building permits within the urban growth boundary. If you want to subdivide or improve your property, you are forced to annex to the city in order to obtain a building permit. Another caveat in the process is, if we, the city, can add a street application to your application, we will expedite the process. That's Eugene's shotgun approach to annexation and has resulted in a patchwork of incorporated and unincorporated areas. The side effect of Senate Bill 417 is that state statutes would require a city to annex only contiguous properties, that is, properties directly adjacent to current city boundaries. And this applies to counties without a boundary commission. The city's forced annexation process is nullified. They can issue a building permit, not require annexation, not collect SDC funds because it's county jurisdiction, or give the whole process back to the county. Developers would definitely benefit as county SDC is less than the city levy. No longer will Lane County and the city of Eugene be able to circumvent state statutes. Please make the Boundary Commission go away and require Lane County and Eugene to follow current state statute law. There's thousands of dollars in the budget to use elsewhere. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? I appreciate that you both drove all the way up here on a very wet and windy morning to testify, and I know this means a lot to you, and I appreciate the contributions you've made to our community.
So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to hear from the mayor of Cresswell, Mr. Ron Petitti.
Good
And I know the mayor of Cottage Grove is here, too, Mr. Williams, but I think you're going to come up with Linda Lundwig. Do you want to do that, or do you want to come up now?
Madam Chair, if it's three of us here.
That'd be great.
Together,
yep, perfect. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Chair, committee members, Gary Williams, Mayor of the City of Cottage Grove. I'm also the immediate past chair of Lane Council of Governments. And I'm not here so much to speak on behalf of all the mayors, of which there are 12 in Lane County, but I can certainly speak for a number of them in regards to the Boundary Commission in Lane County. Before I get too deeply involved, I would like to have Ms. Ludwig with the League of Cities clarify a few things.
Can you pull your mic down just a little bit?
Certainly.
Just kind of get it in front of you a little bit.
Thank
you.
You
are speaking.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. I'm not here to testify in the merits of the bill. In fact, I believe that in terms of the abolishment of the Boundary Commission, the League would be neutral. What I am here to testify in my role as staff person of the League, but also as the chairman of the Senate Bill 887 Annexation Work Group, a couple of thoughts and concerns that I would have about Section 4 and Section 5 of the bill. In a nutshell, this bill does two things. It does abolish the function of the Boundary Commission, and it gives the complete function to Lane County. In terms of how the annexation function works in other parts of the state, counties weigh in at the time that a city forwards to the county a comprehensive plan amendment and a map amendment to the urban growth boundary, at which point the county has to approve. In all other parts of the state, except in the metro regions, cities initiate their own annexation processes, and when those move forward into that comp plan amendment, that's the point where the county weighs in at. This bill would create a completely different system for 12 cities in the state that we have in no other place. It would have the county initiate that annexation process, as well as then move forward to the comp plan approval for the amendment and that map amendment. So I'm here with concerns for the cities of Cottage Grove, Eugene, Springfield, Junction City, Lowell, Oak Ridge, Bonita, West Fir, Coburg, Cresswell, and Florence, and that portion of the bill that would have that Lane County do that upfront piece with the annexation piece. Again, this would create a system that we have nowhere else in the state and would effectuate not only a change for the cities that there are annexation concerns with in Lane County, primarily one, for those 11 other cities. In terms of the other functions that the Boundary Commission does do, I don't have any issues with the testimony you heard from Ms. Rich from Special Districts. In every other part of the state, the county is the primary mover, provides oversight for the formation of any new special districts, as well as boundary changes that school districts have. So that would fall in line with our current system of the governance process for the formation of special districts and as well as school district boundary change. So I don't have any issues with Lane County assuming those roles. I do have a concern for the county in their loss of O&C dollars potentially for their financial means there.
Okay, so so that I understand, your testimony is that if Section 4 and 5 remain in the bill, it sets up a new procedure that no other county has in the state, sort of like the Boundary Commission. We're the only county with a Boundary Commission in the state, so we would change that for some other new way to annex. that no other county in the state has. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair. And I wouldn't. My response was not to eliminate Section 4 and Section 5, but provide some amendment language that would allow the county to take over basically all those other functions, but allow cities to operate as they do in other parts of the state in initiating annexation issues.
Okay. Do you have some suggested language today, or that's just something you wanted to talk about today and work on?
I could get some language back to the committee by the end of the day or to the chair.
I'd just like to see some draft language. It doesn't have to be in LC form, but just some suggested language for talking purposes, particularly because I have a town hall on Saturday.
Okay.
With Representative Chris Edwards, and we planned it this way so that we could go back to our district and talk about what we talked about here today, and I'd like to have some paperwork that I can distribute.
Let me get you some language at the end of the day. In terms of the annexation issue, this is a very roundabout way to deal with annexation concerns through the Boundary Commission bill.
Mm-hmm.
And I am concerned this session with working again with some of those annexation issues and trying in House bill that's currently been dropped to try to complete mm-hmm. the work that we started last session, the work of the interim work group, which I chaired, which I think brought forward and to the light some of those issues that you've heard from citizens in your district mm-hmm. and try to effectuate a positive solution for all cities with that issue. My preference would be to deal with that annexation issue as annexation in statutes rather than trying to fix that issue in a more circuitous fashion through the Boundary Commission bill.
And the bill I think you're speaking of is one that Senator or that Representative Edwards and I have co-sponsored on annexation. There may be others too. Yeah, let's hear from Senator Cruz.
Thank you. Linda, I guess you confuse me. I understand the issue you're talking about, and it probably would be an appropriate fix, but I'm just confused as to, and I may be I need to digest the language a little bit more. I guess I'm confused as to how, as I read it, the bill is dealing with the boundaries of the. I'm not seeing why anything outside of the boundaries of the Boundary Commission would be impacted by this, that it's giving Lane County broader jurisdiction. I mean, for example, Cottage Grove's not in the boundaries of the Boundary Commission. I'm not sure how this bill actually affects them. If it does, clearly it needs to be fixed, but...
I believe it affects them on page 2 in section 4, I would say, line beginning in 10-11 that says, except that Lane County is substituted for the commission in the action proceedings or prosecution. Currently, the Boundary Commission in Lane County does initiate all annexation requests. Rather than the city having the hearings for annexation, the Boundary Commission has that role.
Madam Chair, for the entire county?
Yes, that's
okay.
That's true.
Okay.
Senator Morse, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question would be, do we even need Section 4 and 5 because you have existing law that addresses, if you don't have a boundary commission in other counties and cities, there are laws that address how you annex. Do we even need Section 4 and 5?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I would love to have my legal beagles take a look at that and get back to you. I'm not an attorney, and I wish I could answer that question, but I cannot. But I believe we should look at the Boundary Commission statute and list of duties and see whether or not Section 4 or Section 5 is needed.
Okay. Well, this is just a public hearing today. We'll have another one because we have another hearing coming up. So I'll move on and allow the two mayors to speak, and then we've got two more people we need to squeeze in. So which one of you would like to go first?
Madam Chair, thank you for having us here today. The City of Creswell...
Oh, state your name, please.
Ron Petiti, Mayor, City of Creswell.
Thank you.
The City of Creswell also believes that the Boundary Commission is an extra layer of government that we don't need. We do have concerns, as Mrs. Ludwig pointed out, regarding those issues of Lane County taking over the powers of the Boundary Commission. I have spoken with Sid Lycan, Mayor of Springfield, yesterday, and I have an email from Mayor Phil Brubaker of Florence. They are in agreement with me that they feel that the Boundary Commission is an extra layer of government that we don't need. I'm going to defer to my partner, Gary Williams, to give you some more specifics on our thoughts.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess in a nutshell, it's a pretty simple issue for those of us in rural Lane County. And it's quite apparent, certainly in conversations I've had with mayors and elected officials throughout Lane County, that the Boundary Commission is in all ways, shapes, and forms redundant. That process takes valuable staff time away from various government entities. My city staff spends a great deal of time on issues that end up going before the Boundary Commission and then back to us, and there's just a lot of unproductive time of staff, and as you're well aware, staff at any level of government is heavily taxed these days with many, many tasks, too few people to perform them, and this is just one of those things that seems to encumber a number of cities and their staff. It also slows procedures and progress for people that are trying to move ahead and get some things done. This is another one of those things. We have a short building season, for example, in the state of Oregon. And if you have another 30 or 60 days tied up in a redundant step, in applications and such, people lose the window of opportunity to begin or continue on projects. But the biggest concern that I hear on the issue is local control. Cottage Grove and Creswell and Coburg and Oak Ridge and virtually all the cities across the state, this isn't just germane to Lane County, is the local control issue. We want to have control over and how we grow and how we administer things in our communities. My understanding, the way this is presented at face value this morning, is that with Lane County Board of Commissioners still involved in it, there's a little bit of that local control that makes some of us a little skittish and have some concerns about that. So I would hope that when we're looking for some amendments and some of that language, that we really, for me, that's the heart of the matter. That's what I hear from a lot of folks, is it's the local control that we don't want to relinquish that to yet another government entity that may supersede or not meet our needs. I guess in closing, I would just share with you folks that Cottage Grove is not different than a number of other communities. We annex only by request. We have no forced annexations in our community. People come to us with the request. We should be able to administer and deal with that. When you have, under the current situation with the Boundary Commission, several years ago, Mayor Petiti's city and my city entered into a venture to create a fire district. Cottage Grove was we had a fire department. We also had South Lane Rural Fire Department. So these three entities came together and created a fire district. It went before the Boundary Commission the first time. Everyone was in agreement that this was a good thing at that time. But it went before the Boundary Commission, and the Boundary Commission said, nope, not going to happen. And the prevailing sentiment among those that watched those proceedings was that there was an individual on that board from Florence that had a thing about fire districts, and he wouldn't approve one in this lifetime. So those are the kinds of things, you know, we lost local control with that because someone outside the area was making decisions for our communities. And so that's probably a little bit more insight than you desire.
Well, actually, it's not, Mr.
Insight.
Mayor. It's very good insight. And I guess the question I want to ask you is when we look at the Section 4 where it says that Lane County is substituted for the commission, I'm getting the sense that you would prefer language that said that the local jurisdictions would be substituted for the commission.
Correct.
So you would prefer the cities, and if it's in the county, then it would be the county commission. If it's the cities, it would be within the city.
Correct.
Is that sort of what you're telling us?
Anywhere possible, Madam Chair, where local control is the controlling factor, that, in my view, is not a bad thing.
Okay. All right. Well, this is very good testimony. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have two people I need to hear from next before we move into our next bill. Paula Taylor with the Boundary Commission and Rob Handy. I'll just have you both come up together. Rob, I just need to facilitate the testimony, and I know you're not here sharing views or not sharing views with Ms. Taylor. I just need you both at the table so we can move the testimony. So I would like to hear, let's see, let's save Ms. Taylor for last. Mr. Handy, why don't you tell us what you're here for?
My name's Rob Handy. I am the chair of the River Road Community Organization. I am also the co-chair of the Neighborhood Leaders Council. Eugene has 19 neighborhood groups. Excuse me, good morning. Thank you for having me speak, Chair Walker and Senators. There's 19 neighborhood organizations in the city of Eugene, including two in the patchwork quilt of city and county residences that are in the River Road, Santa Clara area. If you can picture Eugene as a pie, kind of the northwest piece of that pie is that patchwork quilt in River Road and Santa Clara. Santa Clara and River Road are historic communities. They existed and had their own special districts. They had their own heritage. For years, the city of Eugene has been growing in that direction and slowly swallowing up these communities. Mr. Van Sickle and Mr. Seabury were quite eloquent earlier. They are my elders and our elders in the community who have experienced a great deal of pain through the inability of the county and the city and the Boundary Commission to work out these issues of basic fundamental representation for citizens. Ms. Taylor is a wonderful woman. The folks on the Boundary Commission are excellent people in our community, but there is something that needs to be fixed with our current situation. I appreciated the testimony of the mayors, who you just heard. Home rule is important. I would just offer one other thought for you on that, in that part of our challenge out in River Road and Santa Clara is that the county has basically orphaned us to the city of Eugene. Folks in the county want to see more representation from the county for our fundamental rights representation. So the issue of having the cities look after these issues is a two-headed coin to me, in that I know our neighbors out in River Road and Santa Clara want to have the city of Eugene be directly accountable to them for any annexations, and yet they also want the county involved because those are also their elected officials. So I think there maybe needs to be some combination of oversight here if there isn't a boundary commission again, in that the county needs to be involved, the city needs to be involved. Most of all, the residents in River Road and Santa Clara need a voice that they currently don't have with the layer of buffering that the boundary commission seems to insulate elected officials from. And so I'm pleased to see that you are looking at this language. I'm very encouraged that we will have some movement one way or another here, and I encourage you to continue to work out the details of how we're going to move forward with getting these citizens the representation that, and direct accountability from government that they need.
Mr. Handy, your testimony is important because it points out the problem that we have in River Santa Clara, because some people are now in the city and some are in the county. So if the language is that the cities take over the jurisdiction but the county does as well, then parts of River Road Santa Clara are going to go to two different entities to address their concerns, correct?
It is complex how we're going to work out the details of this bill and the sections that previous woman mentioned. But it will be a challenge.
All right. Thank you. All right. You can step back if you wish, and we'll have Paula Taylor finish up.
Okay.
Thank you,
Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Paula Taylor. I am the Executive Officer of the Lane County Boundary Commission. Thank you for having a hearing this morning. It was an interesting drive down in the rain. But I just want to share with you that the Lane Boundary Commission has not yet taken a position on this bill, so I don't have that information to share with you. I would like to offer my assistance to the League of Oregon Cities in looking at Sections 4 and 5 and coming up with language that will transition from Boundary Commission to how other cities and counties do it in the state. I had some of the same questions about the intent of those sections, and I appreciate the comments from League of Oregon Cities and also the clarification and the testimony from the committee members. And I just would be glad to answer any questions if you have, but I just reiterate that I would be available to discuss any modifications or amendments to those two sections, because I think they may have a consequence, as was indicated by Ms. Ludwig, that the Lane County would be given authority that no other county has.
Okay. I appreciate that, and I understand you can't speak to the merits of the bill because you folks have not taken a position. But I would ask that you make yourself available to Ms. Ludwig. She's still in the back of the room, exchanged business cards. Apparently, there was supposed to be a work group put together from last session, and I know that Representative Vicki Berger spent a lot of time on this, and was sort of discouraged when we asked her to kill the bill because we had gotten pressure from our city. But I'm not going to let this one drop. This really needs to be resolved. I think people have clearly stated the problems they have with the Boundary Commission, and I'm not saying that to attack you personally. Simply, it's just not working for folks in our community anymore. So, Senator Cruz, and then we'll okay. Senator Morris, and then we've got to close out.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Morris maybe had a good point here. We need for Ms. Ludwig to take a look at what happens if it's just abolished, what the fallback position is. And I would suggest that you look at the legislative action taken to eliminate the other two boundary commissions, because I would think that would, we could probably mirror that and have the same effect if the effect was positive. And Madam Chair, I'd also suggest, if you're really wanting to get down to local jurisdictions being able to make determinations, you might consider an amendment to eliminate DLCD in the bill.
Don't even go there. Thank you very much.
Just a thought.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're speaking heresy.
I'm curious, what are the fund balances within the commission at present, approximately?
Just a little background. The Boundary Commission, by law, receives its revenues, gets no general fund money from the state. So it receives its revenues by assessments to cities and Lane County on a per capita basis and from special districts on an assessed valuation basis. That stream of revenue generates about 60% of the revenues to the Boundary Commission. The other revenues are made up through filing fees. The current operating budget of the Boundary Commission is about $100,000, and we're about midway through the year, so we're about midway through the collection of assessments. The fees come in based on whatever proposals are filed. And right now, we're probably about, but in our approved budget, there's a dollar amount, about $57,000 is to come. Yes, $57,000 from fees, and we're within $10,000 or $20,000 of that. So we probably will meet that goal, and we also would expect we'd receive all the revenues. So the revenues would generate about $100,000.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Just one other comment related to that. This bill has an effective date of July 1 of 2008, so there could be another assessment budget process of the session of the Boundary Commission, and I think what this bill will allow the Boundary Commission to do is think of an orderly way to do finishing its work and reimbursing the logical payers of those assessments, and so there would be, I think, the transition part of this bill is the feature of the bill that allows for some orderly transition.
Well, I agree with you, and that's why there was no emergency clause stuck on this thing, because it's going to take some time to transition.
Right. And cities are going to have the amount that goes back to the cities probably it's just not known at this point how much that would be, and cities will then have an opportunity to be looking at ways to fund the work that they'll need to do to accomplish annexation.
All
so
right.
That's the other part about the long effective date, I think, is a positive.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate that you drove up today.
Thank you.
Offered your expertise and your willingness to work with us on this bill. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 417. I appreciate everyone who came today. There's a little work to do on this bill. I still need to hear from my district about the bill now that it's in the process and moving, and we'll have a town hall on Saturday to have further discussion about that. Thank you all. Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on our next bill, which is Senate Bill 46. Ms. Richardson, what's this one about?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 46 dedicates $40 million out of the general fund to the Department of Education for the Oregon pre-kindergarten program. It declares an emergency and would take effect July 1, 2007. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, I'm waiting for the sign-up sheet. Alan Bruner, would you like to come up first? Hi, welcome.
Madam Chair, for your record, Lori Wimmer Whalen of the Oregon Education Association. I will have two sentences for you and then turn the mic over to my member, Alan Bruner.
Teacher of the Year, he is.
2006 Teacher of the Year.
Get to one sentence.
I just wanted to put on the record that the Oregon Education Association is a member of what I call the No-Brainer Coalition, because we know that research shows...
I'm not going to go there.
Triple entendre. Research shows that the very best way to reduce the achievement gaps, plural, which is how we like to think about them, is to be sure to give children the best early start in those pre-literacy skills that are so well developed in pre-K and Head Start programs. And so we see this bill as a K-12 investment by another name. And with that, I'd be happy to turn this over to Mr. Bruner, who is a member of our Board of Directors. He is, as you pointed out, 2006 Teacher of the Year, and he has a lot of very great insights for this committee. Thank you.
Great.
That was more than three sentences.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm...
Well, there were a lot of semicolons in that.
Certainly, Mr. Bruner, the excellent educator that he is, understands the either grammatical inaccuracy of Ms. Whalen's testimony, or we'll just stop there.
All right. With that, Mr. Bruner, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record once again, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alan Bruner. I'm a high school science teacher and mathematics teacher at Colton High School. And as was mentioned, I had the privilege of being named the 2006 Oregon Teacher of the Year and had the opportunity to represent all the teachers in the state during that year. But I'm here this morning at the behest of the interim work group, the Senate Commission on Educational Excellence, of whom I see many members.
Totally coincidental, I'm sure.
I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you this morning. This room is filled with educational experts. It's filled with cognitive psychologists. It's filled with economists. It's filled with people who have a passion for early childhood education. And so I will try very hard not to steal what you will hear a little later, but to mention again for the record that at least from an educational psychology standpoint, research would seem to indicate that 90% of what we acquire as human beings basically occurs within the first 6 months of life. So when we wind up looking at the skills necessary to develop language, when we look at the skills necessary to develop the ability to pick up a pencil or pick up a pen or to do all of those other fine and gross motor skills, you'll hear people today talking about the fact that pre-kindergarten is an incredibly crucial time for those pieces of development. You'll hear people this morning talk about how important it is to consider the economic ramifications of funding what may seem to be a no-win and no-return situation when we look at little kids, when we look at four-year-olds and five-year-olds and six-year-olds. And there's some wonderful landmark research that is longitudinal in its scope that would seem to indicate from the cities of Chicago, from Michigan, from California, that the returns on pre-K investment run anywhere from 800% to 1,700%. In other words, $8 return on $1 invested up to $17 returned on $1 invested. Unfortunately, many of us perhaps in this room won't be around to see that return. So, and in fact, as you consider this bill and as you consider what your colleagues are going to do, it's ultimately the issue of whether or not we as a state and you as a legislature are willing to make that particular investment, knowing that the return, in fact, benefits the future. What I would like to do, bluntly, is put a human face on this particular issue. I don't know how many pre-K teachers are in the audience today. I don't know how many kindergarten teachers are in the audience today. And as I said for the record, that's not my area of expertise. I deal with high school students, which is a blast. It's a lot of fun and a very engaging prospect. But I'm not the expert at early childhood education, so I had the privilege of being able to contact and talk with some of my professional colleagues who deal with kindergarten students, who deal with pre-K students. And I'd like to share some of their thoughts with you for the record. I had a chance to talk with Barbara Gordon. She's basically a 25-year veteran in the Molalla School River, the Molalla School River District. Yeah, she's up in Molalla.
And
a river runs through it.
Thank you, and a river runs through it. She teaches at Molino Grade School and does early elementary education. And in talking with her, what she said was poignant and wonderful. And she said that when she deals with children at the kindergarten and first grade levels, she can immediately pick out those children who have been in an environment that has been language rich and arts and music enriched. In other words, she has the opportunity to see how children acquire language early on. and is able to make a true distinction between those children who have had environments where, for example, parents have read, parents have exposed children to the arts, exposed children to music, given them opportunities to do things that, frankly, we would all look at and say, that's just good parenting. In fact, though, the people who benefit from this particular bill are our most neediest in the state. And they are the children of parents who are at risk in our state. And that's one thing to keep in mind. Mrs. Gordon said that those children who wind up coming from such environments have a set of readiness skills. They listen. They attend. They have the ability to actually sit quietly or patiently. They have the ability to focus. And again, we might take those for granted, but if you talk to any kindergarten teacher, he or she would say, no, those are things that we have to enculturate and work with from September till perhaps Christmas. I'd like you to hear from Julie Radisky, who is a kindergarten teacher in the Colton School District and has been there for about 20 years. And she would love to be here today because she could talk for hours and give names and give anecdotes. What she said was, the very first day of school, of kindergarten, it takes about 5 minutes to be able to determine which students have had a pre-kindergarten experience and those which have not. And sometimes it deals with things as small as picking up a pair of scissors or being able to squeeze a bottle of glue and have it hit where you want it to be. And again, we look at those skills and say, that's just little kids' play. You'll hear from developmental psychologists perhaps today in this room who will say, no, those are the building blocks. And the fancy term in education ease is called scaffolding. Those are the pieces that children build upon. And it gives them the opportunity to develop hand-eye coordination, to develop the ability to cross left and right brain areas. It gives them the ability to actually determine where the midline or the midpoint of their body is. It gives them the opportunity to figure out what to do with their bodies with respect to the fine skills required to write our language, to write numbers. So those things wind up showing up in enriching pre-kindergarten programs. And those students that don't come to kindergarten with those skills are at an extreme deficit. She wound up mentioning that she had one child who was not from a pre-K program that basically talked at the level of a three-year-old. Three-word sentences, no pronouns. Did not have the ability to use I, we, me, and so on. And again, we might look at those as minor details. But from a kindergarten standpoint, those become the fundamental building blocks that ultimately the legislation and No Child Left Behind is trying to get us to meet. I'd like you to hear from my principal, David Gilbertson, who was an elementary principal in Sandy. They had the privilege, the opportunity of having an in-house pre-kindergarten program associated with the school's kindergarten program, and they were basically right across the hall from each other. And what he shared with me was the fact that these children from this pre-kindergarten program had the opportunity to be inside a school setting, to understand what it meant to do things like line up. They knew what a library was. They knew it held books. They had the ability to actually look at a cafeteria. And again, if you talk to kindergarten teachers about the whole issue of eating and hygiene and those types of things, they will tell all sorts of interesting and somewhat amusing stories about how children acquire those socialization skills. What Mr. Gilbertson said so poignantly, though, is that they had the luxury of seeing incredible success and being able to see those kids from the pre-K into the K, into grades 1, 2, and 3, was just a wonderful, seamless transition that they had in their district. Last anecdote I would like to share is somewhat graphic and upsetting. But I had opportunity to talk with my former building administrator, Dr. Beth Lund, who is now our middle school principal. She's a licensed speech pathologist. She wound up working in the state of Indiana and the end of the 1970s and through much of the 1980s. She worked with Indiana Head Start program. And she echoed everything that I heard in talking to the other elementary education experts that I spoke with. But what she said is that there's a flip side when we look at the human capital aspect, and this is what she related. She had opportunity to work with a young lady who was nonverbal. And it's not that she didn't have the mechanism throat-wise or tongue-wise, but the child, for some reason, was nonverbal. And as a licensed speech pathologist, she worked with this child in Head Start. And as she got to know Rosie, what she wound up noticing, as did another teacher, is the child came to school one day with obvious signs of physical abuse. There were cigarette burns on her arms. And because the child was just starting to gain verbal abilities, Beth wound up talking with Rosie. And what the child kept repeating was, "Rosie bad, Rosie bad." And Dr. Lund wound up interacting with the child as any licensed speech pathologist would do. And ultimately, she came back around to the issue of, you know, what was the issue? Why was this child punished in such a horrific way? And as it turns out, the father had required the child to perform some sexual act on a family member, and the child had refused. Now, the reason I bring that up in this is when we look at Head Start, when we look at pre-K programs, we also have to look at the human capital and what we wind up looking at with respect to changing lives. What Beth related to me is she can't imagine what it would be like had the child not had the opportunity to gain the verbal skills, to have the ability to have the voice to cry out. And what she expressed was the fear that without programs like Head Start, the most neediest in our society would stay silent. As you folks wind up considering this particular funding, as I said, there's some wonderful economic advantages, and that pleases some people, and there's some wonderful social advantages, and that pleases the people who are looking at, you know, the whole entrance into the judicial system and trying to avoid children being disenfranchised and staying involved in the public ed system and being engaged. I guess what I would ask you to do is to think about all of those pieces as you look at and deliberate this, and that you bring your colleagues along. If you have opportunity, bring in the kindergarten teachers. As you have opportunity, bring in the pre-K teachers, so you have the human face on what these dollars will mean to those children whose lives you will affect forever. Thank you very much.
Mr. Bruner.
Yes, ma'am.
You have this committee's rapt and undivided attention today. I felt it. And I just want to thank you. I know that is why you've been chosen Teacher of the Year in 2006. You could do it again. I really appreciate what you've had to say today. You did put a human face on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for the service on the interim committee that Senator Metzger chaired, and he'd like to ask you a question.
Well, actually, just make a comment. I just want to echo the chair, and thank you, Mr. Bruner, for serving on our commission this interim. Your expertise is majority of this committee, of course, has served on the committee, but those who were not certainly have heard the contributions why we wanted you on that commission. And having you take the time to come down today is very, very meaningful. As you know, we worked on this since last winter, and it's now, as we talked about, the fruits of that. And as you see, the governor now has adopted this idea. The House seems to be adopting this idea, and all that is I think recognition of the fruits of your labor and other members on the commission. I want to thank you very much.
Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, thank you very much.
Thank you, and we also appreciated hearing from the No-Brainer Coalition, so thank you. All right, we've got 40 minutes because we got permission to go 5 minutes over. The superintendent came in. Would you like to be next? And then we'll follow you up with Martha Brooks and Chief Carla Peluso. There's an O on the end.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be brief because I know you want to get everybody in here this morning. Susan Castillo, State Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of Oregon. And I'm just here to add my enthusiastic support for Senate Bill 46. And I also want to commend you and the committee members and for your support, the governor's efforts to help us move forward on this issue, the Senate Commission on Educational Excellence for the great work that you guys did on this issue as well. This is so important, and I'm just really excited that that there's all this wonderful leadership being provided this session to help move us forward. As you know, we currently are only serving 60% of the children who are eligible for Head Start, and right now we have a total of we know that if we add this, that we will have 3,200 new children added to the program. And so fully funding means another 3,200 children who are going to get the comprehensive services that they need. And I think, you know, you're going to hear, you just heard from our wonderful teacher, Alan Bruner, who is so incredible, making the case. And you're going to hear from other wonderful leaders here in the room who are working on this issue as well. And they'll have lots of data and statistics. But I think one of the most exciting things that's happening on this issue in our country and here in Oregon is that, you know, for a long time, child development specialists and educators and others really got the benefits of Head Start and pre-K and what a difference it makes in the lives of our children and in our efforts to help them get a strong start in school. But now there is growing support from economists and business leaders on the economic benefits of us making this investment. People see it as good economic development to invest in children early on. We get a huge return for that investment. And so for me, that is really, really exciting that we're broadening how we talk about it. And not only is it just good, the right thing to do for children, but it's also the economic right investment for our state and our country to invest in children early and help them be successful. And we know that we can avoid a lot of problems down the road if we make this investment. So I'm just here to say, you know, I support your efforts to help us make progress on this. Thank you for your leadership. And anything I can do to help, please call on me. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions in the committee? We appreciate your attendance.
You bet.
Now I'll hear from Martha Brooks and Chief Carla Peluso. Ooh. Nice to see you. Female police chief.
Well, thank you. I'm proud to be one.
I bet. How many are there in our state?
In our state, there are currently 3.
Wow.
And we're having a 4th soon. When the current Hillsborough chief retires, there will be a woman in his place.
Well, I'm very excited and proud. Thank you for joining us today. If you will state your name for the record, we can get started.
Martha Brooks, State Director for Fight Crime, Invest in Kids, and Chief Carla Peluso with the Gresham Police Department. First of all, we would like to thank you, Chair Walker, and the committee for the opportunity to address you today on the importance of Head Start funding. Fight Crime, Invest in Kids, Oregon is a statewide bipartisan, non-profit, anti-crime organization of 137 police chiefs, sheriffs, district attorneys, and other law enforcement leaders. It is part of a national organization of more than 3,000 law enforcement members. We believe that investments in programs such as Head Start and other high-quality early education are proven to give kids the right start in life and will cut crime. Today, Chief Peluso and I are here to talk about the research that proves, in addition to all of its other benefits, Head Start cuts crime and saves money, and encourage you to provide an additional $40 million of funding to the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Head Start. For over 40 years, the nation's preeminent early education program has helped low-income kids succeed in school and avoid a life of crime. Why is Head Start the right start for at-risk kids? Years of research have shown that Head Start achieves 3 strong outcomes for children. Kids learn better at home and in school. Kids get along better with other kids. kids graduate, and earn more in jobs. You take those three results from Head Start, and they add up to savings for Oregonians. In two recent reports, which are in your packet, released by Fight Crime Investing Kids Oregon, estimates show that based on scientific research, if all eligible kids received Head Start, that over the long term, Oregonians will save $500 million per year. Of that total, $300 million is in reduced government expenses and increased tax revenue. Attorney General Hardy Myers stated, "Head Start is the smartest investment our country can make in our youngest at-risk children. When we give all eligible children the opportunity to attend Head Start, every Oregonian benefits."
Law enforcement officers in our states every day spend many hours tracking down and arresting dangerous criminals.
State your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Carla Peluso, Gresham Police Chief.
Thanks.
We know it is imperative to remain tough on crime, but we also know that to win the fight on crime, we must be proactive in dealing with our youth. America's commitment to holding criminals accountable must be matched by its commitment to preventing kids from becoming criminals in the first place. Head Start is key in that formula. In addition to my duties as Gresham Police Chief, I also serve as the chair of the Multnomah County Commission on Children's, Families, and Communities. And during my career, I've also had the honor of serving on the Policy Council for Head Start. I've seen firsthand how our children can beam, can grow, become self-sufficient in their decision-making so that they're making the right choices, so that they're coming in the front doors of police departments to be part of the crime prevention community rather than in the back doors that leads to the jails and prison system of our state. Law enforcement supports the programs that really work. They are proven by research to be effective in cutting crime. Head Start is among the most effective weapon in our crime-fighting arsenal. Head Start is crime prevention. Research supports what my colleagues and I have known for years. Head Start dramatically reduces crime. A national survey of Head Start graduates found that adults who attended Head Start as children were nearly 10% less likely to be arrested or charged with a crime than their siblings who did not attend Head Start. Fight Crime Invest in Kids Oregon analyzed the research and found if Head Start was available to all at-risk Oregon 3- and 4-year-olds, our state could prevent 500 kids each year from growing up to be criminals. 500 kids every year avoiding crime will compound to thousands of prevented crimes and spared innocent victims. A landmark study of the High Scope Perry Preschool, an early education program similar to Head Start, found incredible success in curbing future crime. At age 27, the participants who were left out of the program were 5 times more likely to have chronic lawbreakers than kids who participated in the program. At age 40, the grown-up children who did not attend the Perry Preschool program were 4 times more likely to have been arrested for drug felony and nearly twice as likely to be arrested for multiple violent crimes. A study of Chicago's government-funded child parent centers found that by the age of 18, at-risk kids not in the program were 70% more likely than kids who attended to have been arrested for a violent crime. The child parent centers will have prevented 33,000 crimes by the time the participants reach their 18th birthday. This program also cut child abuse and neglect, so eloquently demonstrated by our Teacher of the Year with his stories this morning, cut child abuse and neglect of children in the program in half. This is incredibly important to law enforcement because study after study after study shows that kids who were abused and neglected are more likely to be arrested as juveniles than similar kids who were not abused or neglected. Fight Crime Invest in Kids cost savings report concludes that with improved quality, Oregon Head Start could get results and savings comparable to the Children, Child, Parent, Center, Preschool. Research shows that Head Start could save $10 for every dollar invested. The $10 breakdown in percentage is as follows: 28% from reduced criminal justice expenses, 28% from less welfare and more earnings, 24% from reduced costs inflicted on crime victims, and 18% from reduced public school expenses. Another way to look at this
is that the savings by providing full Head Start funding to all eligible at-risk kids would cover half the costs of Oregon's prisons. However, to achieve these savings, we need to reach more children. The state needs to provide more support to reach more 3- and 4-year-old at-risk kids. While Oregon Head Start provides critical services to thousands of low-income children and their families, because of a lack of funding, last year 40% of eligible kids could not get Head Start. I've spent my career arresting and locking up criminals, but no prison can bring back a murdered child, and no punishment can undo a crime victim's anguish. To win the fight against crime, we must take serious measures before, not after, tragedies occur. We must make sure every at-risk child gets on the right path to responsible adulthood through Head Start. A national study of early education programs found the average quality of Head Start is higher than other early care and education programs. This success comes from parent involvement and the comprehensive education, health, nutrition, social, and emotional development services that Head Start offers. To bring it home to Gresham, my city, nearly 6,500 at-risk kids were shut out of Head Start last year and denied the chance to get on their road to success. Over 1,100 kids were shut out of Head Start in the Gresham area in the Mount Hood program alone, more than 55% of my community's eligible children. Oregon's law enforcement leaders are united in calling for increased investments in Head Start, because we know helping kids get the right start today and will cut crime tomorrow. I've had the opportunity to visit many a Head Start center, and when I see the spark in those children's eyes as they're receiving, again, those social skills as well as educational support to fit in at their next level of education, to have the strength to succeed and to overcome their challenges, it is one of the most rewarding opportunities that has been afforded me in my career. When I contrast that with again, children I have had to take out of their home because of abuse and neglect, it is a much better use of our time. I thank you for your attention this morning.
And let me finish with a couple more remarks. Mm-hmm. That kids succeeding in school, graduating from high school, and getting higher paid jobs means they're more likely to give back to our communities rather than cost more in special education, welfare, and crime costs. However, today every center in the state has a waiting list. We've been talking about the public dollar return of Head Start. It's important to remind ourselves, like the MasterCard commercial, what Head Start does. Savings to all Oregonians, $500 million. Total in reduced government expenses and increased tax revenue to all Oregonians, $300 million. Cost savings for innocent crime victims, priceless. I'd like to conclude with one of my chief's quotes that he made over at one of our Head Start visits, and that's Chief Miranda in Newport. I think it says everything about why law enforcement supports Head Start. Too many of our kids are on the outside looking in through the brightly colored windows of Head Start. If kids do not have an opportunity to participate in early education, the results may look different. They could be looking out through different windows with bars attached. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the testimony. I'm just struck a little bit by the fact that I don't want people to leave here with the impression that all disadvantaged children are prone to crime. Because that's not true. I mean, I was disadvantaged, and I've come out okay. But I know. I put my foot in that one.
That was Sandra Metzger.
But I think the studies have shown, and we're going to hear some more from some other folks about that, that clearly disadvantaged children have many disadvantages and challenges in their life. And Head Start really can help intervene, and it also brings parents into the program to help them be better parents. Is that? I think that's the key right there.
Senator, you are absolutely right. A child's success is so hinged to the success of their parents or their support group, because we know many of our kids are in the non-traditional family settings. But Head Start makes very strong parents.
that provide that support for their children's success. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, thank you.
And I don't think that most people realize that Head Start is not just an early educational system, but it's an educational system for the families. And you go into those centers, and it's amazing what they're doing and the results that come out.
Well, I've often heard over the years that we should have a license to parent. We don't. You can freely procreate in this country, but there is no place really for people to learn how to be parents. And so that's what I do appreciate about Head Start, is it offers parents that opportunity to be better at their task.
Right.
So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We will hear next from the Ready for Schools group. I think there's a panel of you if you just want to come forward. And then after that, I think all we have is Tricia Smith from ONCA. So I think we should be able to get through our agenda. Do you just want to take the pulse and see who wants to go first and begin and state your name?
Yeah, my name is Richard Alexander, Dick Alexander, and I chaired the Ready for School campaign, and I'm pleased to be here this morning with you and talk a little bit about Head Start. First, I would second the comments of those who've come before us, who's bringing real focus to the issue and commend them for their statements. I would like to start by kind of characterizing to a certain extent what these young people deal with that we're talking about. And as we sit here this morning in this room, there are about 3,200 kids in homes around the state of Oregon that were signed up and wanted to start in a Head Start this last September. And they couldn't start. And they are not attending classes. And they're in their homes. And their homes are oftentimes challenges. It's certainly that people are living below the poverty line and struggling. It can be a single parent. It can be a number of issues in the home. There may be no phone in the home in some cases. There can be instances of substance abuse in the homes, in some of these homes. There have been cases of children's service referrals to some of these homes. So they're facing real challenges. Now, these children will start to school next year, next September, and they'll go to kindergarten. Now, they haven't had the benefit of any type of pre-K. The economic level that they live at doesn't make that possible. They don't have a lot of stimulating conversation in the home oftentimes. Oftentimes, there aren't many books in the home. So they start behind their peers. And when they get into kindergarten, they don't realize initially that they're behind. They just know that they're playing with a lot of new kids and there's toys on the playground and they got a hot meal and they feel pretty good about things. By the time they get to about the third grade, they begin to realize that they're not keeping up with their peers. They're not sure why. And in spite of many worthwhile interventions, they had a handicap when they started, that we had missed that critical period of brain development that could have helped change that for them. And by the fourth and fifth grade, they begin to realize for sure that they're behind their peers and they can't keep up. And they mentally drop out of school. They pretty much decide that they can't be measured by the administrative standards that are being applied to them because they can't do it. They can't keep up. So they keep going to class. And we spend enormous sums of money on special education and other types of interventions to try to help them. But they get to about the 10th and 11th grade and they walk out. And they go out. And then I think, Senator Walker, the point you were making earlier that all kids coming from this environment don't get involved in crime, they don't. But a significant percentage of them, when they walk out, they go out on the street and they are unemployed or underemployed. They are bored. They're hanging out perhaps in a peer group that's not the most positive thing. And it's so easy for them to develop some habits and interests that are not productive. So they're more likely to get involved in the public safety system at some point in time. But then they go on through their life, and unfortunately, they oftentimes fall into the social safety net system and become basic wards of the state for their life. It's really a sad picture. And when they die, it doesn't end, because it's likely if they had children during their lifetime, there's a higher likelihood that their children will repeat that same cycle. So what we're talking about is one of the most important things that we can do to break that cycle and then homes and within families, and that's to give these children the opportunity to have benefits of pre-K and enter school ready to learn, be reading at third grade level, increase the likelihood that they'll continue and graduate, that they'll become productive citizens, they'll pay taxes, they'll be part of their community. And it can be done, and it's been demonstrated repeatedly in the research. There's one piece, Swati Adarkar, who's with us, we'll talk about that more, but one compelling piece of research that I think is relatively new. Jim Heckman, who is a University of Chicago economist and a Nobel laureate, recently published a paper where he indicated that the likelihood of a child graduating from high school who doesn't have the benefit of any type of pre-kindergarten program that comes from the homes below the poverty level is about 29%. So that means, say, 30%. So that means that 70% won't. If you apply that to the model in Oregon today and say there are around 3,000 kids that aren't going to go, and 70% of them probably won't graduate from high school, you've got 2,100. And over the next decade, you have 21,000 that you're leaving behind. Anyway, that's my comments to open this briefly. That wasn't as brief as maybe I should have been, but it's a deep feeling that we need to do something about it. I go back to the Crime Commission years ago where we set out to say, why are we locking so many kids up? And we had a retreat, and we came up and did a study that took us about 9 months, and we were pointed directly at the same thing. Early childhood intervention. It's the most cost-effective way to prevent it, just like these folks were saying up here now. Today, the research is more compelling than it was in those days. Much more compelling.
I'm Gary Withers. I'm also affiliated with the Ready for School effort and the Children's Institute. I'm the Executive Vice President at Concordia University, and we are the home of one of the largest and leading colleges of education in the state. I just want to touch on three issues quickly. The first is structure, second is quality, and the third is gold. And Senator Walker, you're so correct that a lot of us, maybe many of us, maybe most of us, come from households where there are some disadvantages. I was raised by a parent who was indelibly scarred by his time at Guadalcanal during World War II. And he was a very quiet man. But he always said one thing to each of his children. He said, when you start a new project, think of it as building a house. When you build a house, there's one part that is most important. It's the foundation. And when we talk about Head Start, we're talking about the foundation. We're talking about building on the foundation. It has got to be solid concrete. It has got to have rebar in it. Otherwise, it's sand. And we can have the finest programs in the world after that, whether it's kindergarten, whether it's outstanding first through 12th grade, but you're still built on sand, and the structure won't hold. Quality. Lawrence Schweinhardt is the CEO and president, and he was the lead, the principal investigator on the Perry Preschool Study from the inception over the past umpteen years, 40 years. We had him in town, and Dick and Swati and I spent a day with him about 3 years ago. And he cited all the data that you've heard and some of the data you're yet to hear. But the piece that the fact that we recall most vividly was what made the difference. What made the difference in a 3 or 4 year old's life with the Perry Preschool program? You know what it was? It was that this was the first moment in the lives of these kids who were randomly selected to join the Perry Preschool where they were the captains of their own ship. They were empowered for the first time in their lives to help in a small but very meaningful way design their curriculum for themselves. Huge difference. That first moment of control over your own destiny. And then finally, gold. At our College of Education, and if you talk to most teachers, principals, and administrators around the state, you'll ask them, what's the gold standard? Well, the gold standard is the ability to read. If you can't read, you're in trouble. You're in big trouble. At our university, we've been conducting a series of focus groups with the African-American communities. We helped start something with a number of leaders in the community called the Black Parent Initiative. It's designed to empower African-American parents to become more involved in their children's educational development. And they have a strong desire to do that, but they have asked for help in moving forward with that. In the process of the last focus group that we ran, I asked the question that we asked of everybody, do you think your parents should be involved in your school? And most of the focus groups were middle schoolers and high schoolers. In this focus group, there was a young lady there who was a third grader who had been promoted to fourth grade. She sat right next to me, and everybody else was writing the answer down. And suddenly I felt a tug on the sleeve. And she looked up at me. And by the way, she was by far the brightest face in that group. She could light up this room and any room with her smile and the twinkle in her eye. And she said, Gary, I'm being promoted from third to fourth grade, but I can't read. Does yes begin with a Y, and is this how I make a Y? And in North and Northeast Portland, in parts of all of our communities, all ethnicities, there are a plethora of very bright 3- and 4-year-olds, come from disadvantaged households, low-income households, who need this foundation. They need this concrete under them so that they can succeed. You're considering raising standards for science and math, and that makes great sense. Guess which group will be the first group to be left behind on those standards for science and math? Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Swati Adarkar, the Executive Director of the Children's Institute, and ditto as far as the comments that have been made this morning. You know, I think we've had an incredible benefit in the research world in the last 20 years, and it's not only economists who've given us great data on the return on investment, investing early, but also the power of neuroscience. We now know that 90% of the brain develops before kindergarten. So if we're putting those building blocks in place well before kindergarten and not taking advantage of that developmental window, we've missed out on the area where we can have the greatest impact. We also know that the achievement gap is well entrenched before kindergarten. Starting in kindergarten is just too late. We also know that those kids who are starting behind are most likely to be low-income children. And, you know, quite frankly, the research has been done over and over again. High-quality pre-K has more longitudinal and short-term data than any social and educational program I'm aware of. And we know that the most promising strategy for narrowing that achievement gap is a program like Head Start. 2 years, age 3 and 4, of high-quality pre-K, where we involve the parents and make sure kids get those basic health nutrition services. We know it delivers in cost benefit time and time again. And, you know, I know of no other strategy where you have this clear consensus, whether it's economists, psychologists, neuroscientists. In my, you know, 20 years of children's advocacy, I've never seen this clarity in terms of the research pointing to an investment. And we have more than 3,000 kids waiting to be served and an opportunity to close that gap. Thank you.
Thank you. I made the comment a while ago that, you know, I was a disadvantaged child and I turned out okay. But as I've sat here and listened to the testimony and I listened to Mr. Bruner, you know, I was abused as a child. And had I been in Head Start, had my parents been involved, you know, maybe my mother could have gotten some help because she was being abused. Someone would have found out a little earlier and I wouldn't have had to be abused for 10 years. So I see the value here. I see the value. Yesterday or Tuesday, I guess it was, we had testimony about kindergarten and all-day kindergarten programs. And I'm trying to, you know, I made the comment that we only have so much money, even though everybody thinks we have a lot. We only have so much. And lowering class sizes, Head Start, investing in Head Start, or all-day kindergarten, which one are we going to do, or which combination of those, and which has the most bang for the buck? Clearly, I think what you have shown us today is this has the most bang for the buck, because we can catch those kids before they go into kindergarten and help them and their families. So I appreciate your testimony. I'm sorry I took your staff. I did want to apologize for that. Allison De La Torre is now on my staff, and it's just a dream having her here to help us develop education policy, and I'm sorry it's your loss, but it is our gain.
But, you know, it's Oregon's gain because we are all working toward the same end goal, which is helping kids succeed. So it's a pleasure to share her on the other side.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Senator Westland.
Just a comment. I'd like to expand maybe just a little bit on Mr. Alexander's very salient point with regard to the 70-30 graduation rate. It's not just that those that don't graduate. You look at those that do finish with a slower start. And then you put in context what on the surface, you go, $40 million. You line that up and p-
put it relative to the billions we spend. And you just, from a business return on investment, maximizing a precious public resource, you know, see very clearly the advantage just for those that actually would have graduated but with reduced learning through the compendium of K-12. I appreciate very much you bringing that point up, and it, I think, speaks loudly to the overwhelming crying need for the not only the funding but the implementation of the public policy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Thank you. You're welcome. Tricia Smith, you're our last guest today. You want to come up and take this one home? I had wanted to move this into work session today, so we have until 20 after. I'm going to leave it in your hands to make this brief.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent the educators working in Head Starts, K-12, community colleges, and a variety of other educational settings very proudly, and I'm here proudly today in support of Senate Bill 46. I'll tell you, Madam Chair, there have been some lonely years as we've advocated for Head Start funding in this building, as it has been overshadowed by the other parts of education, which are also critically important to all of us. And it is a joy to be here today with so many very important people talking about this as a policy issue that affects all of our lives and in our entire state in a number of ways for the long term into the future. As Senator Westman said, $40 million seems like a lot of money until you think about all the money that that $40 million saves. And my daddy used to say, sometimes it's not what you make, it's what you save. And in this case, it's certainly what you save. What you save is hundreds of millions of dollars in costs to our society and our government that are unnecessary. And what you save is the pain to families and communities and the resultant inability to succeed that occurs when we ignore these children at a time when we can indeed save them and their families from a fate they don't deserve. You've heard all the educational reasons to support Head Start. You've heard all the crime prevention reasons. You've even heard the economic reasons for all of us to support Head Start, so I won't go through those anymore, especially if you're ready to move this bill. I will tell you, though, that Head Start is an educational program that we should look at patterning in all areas of education because it's a holistic program. It deals with the whole child and the whole child's environment and all the things that affect that child's ability to learn. And we could do that in a number of settings in our education system. So once we fix Head Start by providing it to all the children that deserve and need it, let's move beyond that and look at this as a model for our other educational pursuits and make sure that all of our children are fed, all of our children get there on time, and all of their children have a support system that will help them succeed in their future and ours. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. And, you know, you're a registered lobbyist for the Capitol Club. You're around the building all the time. But I don't get tired of hearing from you folks because you come here with a passel of knowledge that's really important for us to hear, and you're representing your members, and I appreciate that you came today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 46, and I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 46.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 46 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 46 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Do I have discussion? I bet I do.
I'm sure it's all been said.
Yeah. Glad it's on its way.
Yeah, I think this is a really wise investment for our money, and I know that there's a bill in the House that has a different funding stream for Head Start, but we don't need to worry about that. We just need to get the bill down to Ways and Means. Senator Morse?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a yes on this bill today. In policy, this is excellent policy, but it has to be factored in the context of the broader picture of funding, and so that is an issue that obviously will be addressed in Ways and Means. And I do have concerns about, well, can we do it all? But as a matter of policy. This is excellent policy.
Give us a head start.
Very good.
Madam Chair, I was going to be silent, but just to put this on the record, as we work through all the issues over the interim on the commission and actually working through all these issues for a decade, I clearly think that we do need to be able to prioritize, but getting these children who don't have all of the assets in place that many others do onto a level playing field at the beginning, I think, is incredibly significant. And I'm just saying this for the record that I hope that the Ways and Means folks do look at the reason that we sent this policy package down and the fact that we do think as I prioritize that this should rise to the top.
Thank you, Senator Wesson. Did you want to make a comment?
Just a response to the good Senator Morris's comment. Frank and I agree on many, 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 and I know he's not disagreeing on this, more issues than we have differences on. But we have had this discussion, as Representative Cruz says, for the decade we've been here. And there's always some reason. I mean, there are glaring needs, and certainly they will all not be met. We do have to prioritize. But at some juncture, the overwhelming evidence continues to mount up, and it becomes incumbent for us to act, even if it's not as convenient as we might like. And I know you're not disagreeing with this, but I just have to say that when the opportunity presents itself and the coalitions have been built, I can think of few things that we can do to better serve not just our constituents, but the entire state of Oregon, than to finally seize the opportunity to provide pre-K services through Head Start to the children of Oregon. I just can't say that strongly enough, and I appreciate very much, Madam Chair, your bringing this forward. I know you're not disagreeing, Frank, but the time has come.
And as Mr. Bruner said today, we need to look at the human capital and the ability to change lives. Without programs like Head Start, the most neediest of our society are kept silent. I couldn't agree more.
And we're very concerned about Jeff's weak motion. We think it should go to Ways and Means with a very strong do-pass recommendation.
All right. Ms. Gravel, would you take the roll?
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 46, having been approved, is on its way to Ways and Means. I'll close the work session. And, colleagues, I just want to remind you that next Thursday is the last hearing date that we can introduce committee bills. So if anybody's got a bill draft out there they want dropped through a committee, we need to get that to Ms. Richardson. And next Friday we have our road hearing in Ashland. Talk to each other about catching rides if you'd like to. We can carpool. And thank you all for your attendance today. I appreciate your time. We're adjourned.